Welcome to the Arts Incubator of Richardson podcast series and Airtime with Chris Tucker. Airtime uses a radio show format and features a guest artist who shares about their art and experiences. This program was recorded on February 15th, 2012.
Welcome to Airtime here at the Repertory Company Theater. My name is Chris Tucker, and I am your moderator. In my years as a radio announcer for WRR, a composer, performer, and conductor, organizations such as AIR, Arts Incubator of Richardson, engage its communities with worthwhile events to showcase the arts. Airtime is a program designed to be a collective think tank on the arts, and we accomplish this by bringing in the artists from our community and engaging our audience members. Well, in radio broadcasting, time is an important component. So to help us along the way, we have someone keeping an eye on the clock. When time is up for a particular section, we'll hear this sound, a slide whistle. Before I introduce our guest, David Fisher, we have a very special presentation for a remarkable woman and strong advocate for the arts. To make this presentation, here is Miss Michelle Thames and Miss Abby Kratz.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's such a great pleasure to be here. I'm Michelle Thames, Assistant City Manager for the City of Richardson, and I'm joined this evening by our Chairman of the Arts Commission, Abby Kratz. And we do indeed have a very special presentation for this evening. We wanted to recognize one of your own, so to speak, here at this Airtime event, in that we want to recognize Kitty Goddard for her service on the Arts Commission. Now, Kitty began serving on the Arts Commission in January of 2001. She served for 8 years until January of 2009. And I know you're probably thinking, why are we doing this right now? But Kitty did receive a plaque from the city and the traditional ending to service on one of our boards and commissions. But the Arts Commission, of course, has their own way of doing things from time to time. And in the past, they have historically recognized retiring members through either a reception or event or through a donation of some kind. And so we have something of that particular nature to present tonight to Kitty. It's never too late to recognize good service that has been contributed so kindly by someone as Kitty over the years. And so while we're a little bit delayed in this, we certainly want to make sure that we properly recognize the 8 years that Kitty served, both as a member and chairman of the Arts Commission. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about her service on the Arts Commission while we're at it. She served 8 years and participated in 8 different grant cycles, through which over $2 million worth of public funds were invested in over 30 local arts groups. As a member of the commission, Kitty participated in the final stages of development and the opening of our very own Eisman Center, which will now celebrate 10 years in September. So instrumental in that process, no doubt. We have served over 1.5 million patrons at the Eisman Center, and we are just thrilled, you know, to have that 10 years already booked, and we'll be looking forward to the future of that as well. But as a part of the Arts Commission, Kitty was involved in that opening process, and we certainly want to recognize her contributions to that. Kitty's leadership on the Arts Commission was also very instrumental to the evolution of the Arts Commission into a board that was not only active in making recommendations to the City Council about how to allocate arts grant funding, but also in actively engaging and developing strong arts organizations. While Kitty was the leader of the Arts Commission, they developed workshops and did various things to help strengthen organizations and encourage collaboration. And so we certainly want to recognize that. She graciously shared her tremendous knowledge and expertise in nonprofit management with the groups, some of whom needed it even more than others as they were burgeoning arts groups starting off, or maybe had gotten lost along the way. Along with her counterparts in the commission, she championed identifying Richardson as an arts destination and reported several times the state of the arts to the city council as required by ordinance. Kitty's steadfast and endless devotion to the arts in Richardson has just been a wonderful contribution that she has made to us. And to recognize her service, we're getting to the punchline here, we are going to be donating 7 books to the library collection on art books. And our library staff has assessed the collection and looked for things to help fill in. And so we'll be making a financial donation to the library. Steve Benson, our director of library services, is here tonight to technically receive that donation. And I'll just read quickly the names of the books. I haven't talked with Steve yet about this, but I was thinking about on the way over here, we could probably arrange for you to be the first person to check them out, if you would like. and of course, we'll have a book plate in the front of it that will recognize you and your service and the donation on behalf of that service. The books are The Creative Photographer by Katherine Anderson, Creative Pilgrimage, An Exploration of Artful Gatherings and Discovery of Innovative Art Techniques by Jenny Doe, Digital Image Transfer by Ellen G. Horowitz, Encaustic Mixed Media by Patricia Baldwin Segebruch, One Drawing a Day, a 6-week course exploring creativity with illustration and mixed media by Veronica Lawler, Printmaking and Mixed Media by Dorit Alicia, and Royal Fabergé by Caroline Du Guitar, I think. And so those 7 books will be in the library. Hopefully those of you in the audience tonight or those listening later on will make note of those and possibly check those out as well. But we certainly thank Kitty for her service to the community, and I know Steve and the library staff and the patrons of the library will certainly enjoy the donation. I do want to allow time for Abby to say a few remarks as well. So, Abby, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Michelle has summarized beautifully a lot of the contributions that Kitty has made to the arts and to the city and to the general art scene in Richardson. I'd just like to speak on behalf of the commission itself. And thank you, Kitty, for incredible leadership. You were never quiet. And I know you're not now. You're one hard act to follow, let me tell you that. The commission misses your remarks, your leadership, your very forthright way of encountering all of the issues that needed to be accounted for when they needed to be encountered. So thank you, Kitty. And this is a small thing, but I'm delighted to see that we've got so many things, so many books here that Steve has selected that have to do with digital arts and the future of the arts, because I think you're right on top of that, and I think AIR is a testimony to that, where you're going and where you're going to continue to lead us. So thank you, Kitty. Yeah.
I do want to note that in our audience this evening, we have former members of the Arts Commission as well that served with Kitty, Dennis Kratz and Gene Felstead, as well as folks who benefited from the funding, and David McNair, who is currently on the Arts Commission. So many of the folks in this room know the service and the commitment and the influence you have had on the arts in Richardson, and hope this small donation towards the library will also help mark that as well. Thank you, Kitty.
I'm in the hot seat now. I just wanted to tell everybody here tonight that really the arts have been so ingrained in me for my entire life that I'm simply acting out of passion and caring for what I perceive to be the difference that the arts make in everybody's lives. So I really accept with great appreciation the books that will be going to the library, and I hope that I do get to be one of the first people to check them out. But believe me, if somebody comes before me, please let them have them, because I want to encourage the participation. But thank you all so much, and I feel very honored and very humbled.
Please help me welcome Mr. David Fisher. you for joining us this evening. We might need to get you a higher chair. Well, David Fisher is currently the executive director for the Turtle Creek Chorale. Over the past 20 years, he has given his heart and soul through artistic advocacy and creative artistic management to the citizens of Dallas and the entire Metroplex, working for such organizations as Dallas Children's Theater, the Bathhouse Cultural Center, City of Dallas Office of Cultural Affairs, and WRR Classical 101.1. In addition to being an arts administrator and a parent, he writes for the New York Times, makes soap, and is an avid collector of Christmas music of all times. So my first question is soap.
How it came about, I've always been sort of crafty.
Okay.
And there was one of those book club offers. I think it was like Crafter's Choice Book Club. It was one of those you get 5 books for $1 and you only have to buy 2 more. So I ordered 5. I got candle making, soap making, concrete furniture, something about wood, and one I don't even remember. And the soap one, soap making is this sort of really odd combination of chemistry and cooking and art and mad scientist, and yet you create something that's very sensual, mm-hmm. that you is very and also very practical. So it's a very frugal thing, and it just stuck. So,
good. I was curious. I wanted to hear about that story. Well, before there was David Fisher, the executive director, there was arts management of a different kind in your world, that of theater production. You told me about your love of theater, wanting to direct plays, and in fact, your first college degree was in theater from Cal State Sacramento. How far back did your love of theater go, and wasn't it theater that brought you to Dallas?
Yes. Reminiscent of Kitty's remarks, it's just always been sort of part of me. I was in the band in third grade and tried out for my first, I always say, I tried out for my first play in the sixth grade and just didn't stop. So there wasn't any, when I went to college, there just wasn't any. And I guess I can, you know, some people bemoan, you know, not having great guidance from their parents, but my parents sort of said, well, you want to be a theater major? Yeah, go ahead. I hope it works for you. So they, you know, I was a theater major in college and just continued on with the great faith that would work out. And that, there's a blog post that's been going around on Facebook and such. It's sort of like the 10 great lessons that being a theater major taught me. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, it sounds sort of sarcastic, but it's really kind of true in that there's all these notions of project management and dealing with people and dealing with budgets and time frames and being thinking outside of the box and working on deadlines and all of those things. So that I think theater teaches you. And while usually in job interviews it takes me a little while to sort of demonstrate those skills and convince the other people that really is part of my skill set. Once they get it, they get it. And I've been very blessed to sort of land in the positions that I have. Actually, I owe a great debt of gratitude to the city of Richardson. I was sitting there realizing that one of my first big breaks as an arts administrator is I was the interim general manager of the Meyerson, because the general manager of the Meyerson got hired away to run the Eisman Center. So when Bruce McPherson, who's still the manager of the Eisman Center, went away, the director of cultural affairs called me up and said, okay, I need you to go to the Meyerson and go figure out how to run the Meyerson. And I spent a couple weeks with Bruce and learned everything I could, and I was GM of the Meyerson for a little over a year. And then when at the time I was manager of the Bathhouse Cultural Center, mm-hmm. and was then able to sort of take that experience back to the Bathhouse and sort of, you know, learn and apply and do those sort of things. But you know, it looks good on a resume to say I was GM of the Meyerson Symphony Center.
The cities of Richardson and Dallas do share some connections, don't they?
So I'm eternally grateful to Richardson for that. So.
Well, before we continue, I want to ask you about some of the plays you directed. Mm-hmm. But you did mention, and I'm an instrumentalist, so I want to know, what did you play in band?
I started out playing tenor sax.
Okay.
But for a third grader, it was kind of too big to carry to the bus stop. So I ended up going to trumpet after that.
Okay, that's good. A smaller instrument to carry over. So, well, tell us about some of the plays you directed. I remember one winning an award from Echo Theater, I believe.
That was a production I directed for Echo Theater, which is still around and actually right now doing a production at the Bathhouse. Mm-hmm. At the TACA Awards, grant funding awards, were several weeks ago, and several of the theater companies that got awards there that night started at the Bathhouse, and a couple of them were even, I was there and started them, or not started them, but was there partnering with them as they got started. Echo was one of those theaters, Caramia Theater was one of those theaters that started at the Bathhouse. So this was in 2003,
okay.
And they came to me and to direct this show. It's a show by Carol Churchill, sort of political feminist, fairly edgy play. The first act takes place in colonial Africa, and then the second act takes place in... when the play was written, 1980s New York City, except the characters are all the same, except they've only aged about 10 years. So about half of the cast is played by the opposite gender, and that's used as an instrument in the play. So for example, in the first act, which takes place in British colonial Africa, there's a husband and wife, but the wife is played by a man. And so it really points up this, when you have a man dressed as a woman playing a woman, being oppressed by a man, it sort of heightens your sensitivity to the meaning behind that. They have a slave. The husband and wife in the first act have a slave, except he is played by a white man instead of a black man. So, and in the second act, the husband in the first act ends up playing a 7-year-old daughter in the second act. So you have this towering man in a tiny little dress and little red slippers. So it was really, really an amazing, delightful, passionate, funny, heartbreaking play.
Well, along with your artistic work, you found time to attend the University of Dallas to pursue arts management. Now, you must have been quite driven to balance a great deal of work along with attending school. What was your purpose for pursuing an MBA, and did you ever consider it would turn into a position of great influence within the city of Dallas through a director position with the Office of Cultural Affairs?
Well, I think I had just started as manager of the Bathhouse. This was 98. And University of Dallas was expanding its MBA program. So they actually started a relationship with the city at that time where some of the classes were actually taught at City Hall. And there was a scholarship. And so it became very easy to get an MBA. And the city had tuition waiver, and University of Dallas had a scholarship, and so it was like, well, you know, why not?
Right.
So actually, when I got into the program, I hadn't really looked forward, and I ended up spending 7 years getting it because I would sort of take one class at a time, or sometimes two classes, or do an intermester or something like that, but. You know, I got it 7 years done 7 years quicker than if I hadn't done it. So it was great. And my first graduate degree was in theater again, in directing. And while an MFA is considered a terminal degree, again to job interviews and resumes, it kind of looks and an MBA has a little more weight to it. And as a, you know, as a person who kind of tries to balance left brain and right brain activities and tries to look at business from a creative side and look at creativity from a business side, it seemed, at least I thought then, that the MFA and the MBA combination would go well together. The SMU's graduate arts management program mm-hmm. is a master's degree and an MFA combination. So,
but your MBA was specific to nonprofit.
Was specific, and it was not in arts management. It was
right.
in nonprofit management. So a little broader class structure.
Well, you just spoke about duality, and I have another question in relation to duality. At this point in your career, you directed theater and then worked for the City of Dallas Office of Cultural Affairs, which also included a stint as interim general manager for WRR. So you actually belong to a select class of individual who has seen both sides of arts funding. Here's the duality. Someone who sought government funding for your organization, and on the other side, a person of influence who assists in deciding how arts groups are funded. What kind of insights can you provide being a part of both sides of the veil, as
right,
we spoke
right.
earlier?
Right, well, I mean, as a grant maker, I certainly read a lot of good grants and a lot of bad grants. Certainly now, as a grant seeker, I'm able to sort of understand the process a little better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unlike how being a director of a theater piece helps me to be a better actor, mm-hmm. or rather at least audition better, because I know that if I'm going in for a 90-second audition, I have 90 seconds to hook it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the same with a grant. You have to be so succinct and understand what the grant maker, whether that's a city or a foundation or a private donor,
mm-hmm.
is looking for. What is it that motivates them to give? What is their reason for giving? And then you just find, it's not making it up, you find the places where your mission overlaps with their mission.
Right.
And hone in on those and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do with the money. Here's why it's important. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And get in and out and make, because those, I mean, we would have grant panels where we would see, you know, over the course of 3 or 4 days, 100 grants or more. Or with our major organizations, at least 40. So we would have 40 presentations of 15 or 20 minutes each, where each of those organizations would come in and say, why is it important?
What can we do as patrons and lovers of the arts to show our community leaders that funding the arts is important?
Wow, that's a great question. Making sure that your community leaders know that these places are important,
mm-hmm.
that quality of life includes more than just includes trees and potholes and crime and police and fire and all of those things that we think of immediately when we think of quality of life, but that there's something about the soul of a city that is really important. And it's so intangible. One of the things I did as assistant director of the Office of Cultural Affairs was I dealt with a lot of the administrative tasks. And one of the great challenges was working on performance measures for the city. I mean, the city is the city of Dallas is a, you know, $2 billion organization.
Right.
And, you know, reports and reports and reports to the taxpayers and the bloggers and the editorial boards about, you know, what they're doing with the money. And so they have to be very objective, saying, here's what we are doing with your tax dollars. And when you're just measuring potholes filled, it's pretty easier. When you have a really a measure that's really understandable, like the crime rate or the number of homicides, it's fairly easy to measure. But how do you measure the number of children who were inspired by the play they got to see,
right.
Or the number of adults who did better at their jobs because they were able to take part in a music program, or just the overall sort of feeling that a city is a really cool place to live. There isn't a measure for cool place to live.
We just have to just tell our story.
Exactly. And so that's I think that is important. So when you go to your elected official and say, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Elected official, I'm in your district and I care about this place. Mm-hmm. I care about this theater, this dance troupe, this piece of public art, this gallery. The arts are important. Please continue to fund them.
Well, you've had a tremendous career in arts management. And now life has brought you to the Turtle Creek Chorale. What drew you to the chorale and the desire to work with such a great music organization with a mission to entertain, educate, unite, and uplift?
Well, I had the first time I ever worked with the see, I owe it all to the city of Richardson again. The first time I worked with the chorale was when I was at the Meyerson. We did actually an enormous production called Sing for the Cure, which was one of the really landmark productions, collaborations that Turtle Creek Chorale did with the Komen Foundation. So this was in 2000. And so they've always been sort of on my radar. I worked with some of their ensembles when I was at the Bathhouse. And then, you know, they were one of the funded groups that were funded by the Office of Cultural Affairs, mm-hmm. So I knew them. I knew the longtime artistic director Tim Seelig and his partner for many years, knew the most recent artistic director Jonathan and his partner while they were here, mm-hmm. So they've been on my radar for a while, and when it came time to know that I was looking for my next great adventure, the job happened to come open. And the rest, I suppose, is history. Everything just fell into place.
Well, right about the time you came on, there came an opening for another position in the organization, the prestigious position, as you mentioned, of Tim Seelig, uh-huh. The artistic director position. So how is that going, and what is the process like with it?
Yeah, that was an interesting. They offered me the job and then said, "Oh, by the way,
this is what you have to do.
We have a challenge." So it's certainly been an interesting process. The board has taken great care of the organization, and so the process is moving along. I mean, I think any time in an organization where you have significant executive change, mm-hmm. You have both great challenge and great opportunity. So sort of a new frontier. We brought on an interim conductor right after I came on, and he and I have worked very well together, and the board formed a search committee to identify the next artistic director, and that process is going along. We received a number of applications, quite a few applications, and have been moving through them.
Well, tell us about some of your upcoming programs for the Turtle Creek Chorale. I love the idea of this March concert.
The March concert has actually been a sort of fascinating evolution. Due to the sort of sudden artistic transition, mm-hmm. We sort of, you know, walked in and said, okay, here's what we have to work with. And while the season had been, while the bones had been put out of what the season, or rather even just the sort of shell, we knew what the titles of the shows were, But that's kind of it.
Right.
So we knew that this March show, which was originally called Madonna Madonna, was supposed to be this mashup of songs about the Virgin Mary, sort of sacred music, and pop star Madonna. And there was going to be some sort of video mashup all together something. And that's sort of what we knew. And so Trey Jacobs, the interim conductor, and I sort of said, okay, working within this framework, what is it that both resonates with us as artists? What resonates with our members as singers? And what do we think will resonate with our artists, or with our audience? Because those are all really important decisions. Mm-hmm. And so we started exploring, you know, why is the Virgin Mary important, and why is Madonna such a pop star? And we sort of started riffing on that idea of influential women, of powerful women, of strong women, of women who have taken a stand, whether in many, many different ways. And so the show evolved into really a celebration of powerful women. And originally we're like, really? Because you wouldn't normally think that a chorus of men, 200 men, would be particularly well equipped to suddenly sing all about women. But it actually is really working really well, because sort of like we were talking about with the production of Cloud Nine.
I was thinking about that,
where when you suddenly put women's words into a man's mouth, it heightens your sensitivity. It heightens how you look at it, and the music is just gorgeous. I mean, there is a Russian piece by Rachmaninoff that is a treatment of the Ave Maria text, mm-hmm. that is just stunning. And the first tenors are singing way high up in their falsettos, and so it almost sounds like a mixed choir. Mm-hmm. And then there are pop star Madonna songs. There are songs about Rosa Parks and Mary Queen of Scots. There is a stunning song that the text was written by Helen Keller. Mm-hmm. And it's Helen Keller talking about sunsets and majestic vistas and mountains and nature and love. And the men were really struck by this notion of how can this person who was blind and deaf write so poignantly about something she never saw. Mm-hmm. And it's just a gorgeous piece. As well as there are some Beyonce and some Gloria Gaynor, I Will Survive, and some really fun stuff. We have two really gifted soloists, female soloists coming in, and they are really going to rock the house.
And what day was this going to be?
This is Sunday, March 4th at 8 p.m. at the Meyerson Symphony Center.
Is there a website we can go for more information about the Turtle Creek Chorale?
You can. It is very easy, turtlecreek.org.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, at this time, let's turn to the audience for any questions.
Well, I have a question. You were talking about your directorial experience and past and your management past, but I'm thinking more of the directorial, and now in your role with a chorus, what do you see of your directing the audience in a storyline that translates, that you would use maybe in a show for a chorus? And I'm asking this too as a chorus member. I'm a member of about 120 women Sweet Adeline chorus. And so I'm just curious as to your thoughts as to how you put a show together from a directorial concept to interact with the audience. Did you understand that question?
I think so, but okay. Tell me if I don't answer your question. It's actually one of the things that Trey Jacobs, our interim conductor, is really gifted at, is sort of crafting the flow of a concert. And this actually goes back to my collecting Christmas music. One of the things I love to do is make we used to call them mixtapes. Now we don't call them tapes anymore, but CDs. You know, where you're sort of you sort of plot the rhythm of what the songs are. You know, you start with a fast one, then you pull it back a little, and then you really go for the sappy song, and then you jazz it up a little, and then you take intermission, and then you showstopper at the beginning of the second act, and then you do the three or four slow important songs, but you end with a bang. So I think that's I think in music, like if you were putting together a symphony or any sort of other musical review, I think understanding the experience of the audience and how crafting that experience is really important. Trey likes to say, actually, and he's quoting Tim Selig, where he says you want to make every audience member have a laugh, a tear, and a little bit of a chill bump. In each concert, and when you can attain all of those, you've succeeded. And I think that's the same in theater. I think it's the same in music, art, a gallery exhibit.
Do you do a regular season? I mean, you know, specific shows, spring, fall?
Yeah, we will usually do 4 or 5 programs. Some of them are one night only. Some of them, like our holiday concert, which is very popular, will have 3 or 4 performances. And then we do a number of community events or other sort of pickup events. There's a big show coming to town called Do You Hear the People Sing? At the American Airlines Center. It's from the composers of Les Mis and Miss Saigon and Brian Stokes Mitchell and Leah Salonga is coming on. Well, the chorale is going to be the backup. We're going to be the choir, the 100-person choir that's backing this up. So we get to do really fun stuff like that, too.
Where do you regularly rehearse?
Our home is the Salmon Center for the Arts, which is over on Harry Hines in the Oak Lawn area. And they their facility is great for us because it not only has office space and some small rehearsal space, but it has one great big rehearsal room that is acoustically really lovely and can fit 200 guys in.
When you did a collaboration, I believe it was last year or so, with like Tuna and Turtle, where you did the Greater Tuna mix with it, was that financially lucrative for you guys? You were planning to do more things like that, or was that not your bag?
Turtles and Tuna, I think, was actually several years ago, because I actually think it was at the Majestic, but it was when I was at the Majestic, so maybe 07 or 08, and I don't know the numbers on it. My impression is that it was really successful, and we have spoken about doing something like it again. So to answer your question, yes, absolutely. Collaborations like that are fabulous, and when you can bring together two arts organizations that resonate with each other, that there's some synergy with each other, whether it's through their missions, through their audiences, through just the art that they're producing, I think those kind of collaborations work best, and are really good for the organization. I mean, we have one of our concert in May is an example of a really good, actually multi-tiered collaboration. We're bringing in the U.S. Army Chorus, which we brought in 2 years ago, which they're just a phenomenal chorus of professional singers that are all part of the U.S. Army. and they sang with us 2 years ago, and actually, and so they're coming back in May, in an all sort of American composers concert. But we needed an orchestra to back us up with that. So rather than just hire, get a pickup orchestra that we could just hire anyone, we're partnering with the Lone Star Wind Orchestra, of which Mr. Tucker, I hear, mm-hmm. is involved. And so as a way of bringing the two organizations together, and even marketing it, I mean, they have it on their website as one of their performances. It's not just a rental gig that they're running out and doing. It's actually one of their performances that they're promoting as part of the body of their work. And so they will bring their audiences, they'll bring their people, and everyone. And we will sort of hope to cross-pollinate the audience.
I have another question. This goes back to, you were saying that you need to have something that's crafted that resonates with the artists themselves and with the audiences. Do you have any methodology that you use to kind of have your finger on the pulse of your audience as to what directions you need to take, or do you just kind of go, well, this sounds good, let's go for it, I bet they'll like it, kind of thing?
Boy, if I knew the answer to that, I'd you know, if we could bottle that for arts organizations, that's what the city of Richardson needs to work on. I mean, our city of Dallas, that's what we all need to work on. I mean, that really is the magic question, is how do you gauge the audiences? And,
well, I mean,
and
do
as
you
a,
even use surveys? So
you
just,
use surveys, just, you hang out in the lobby, you
yeah.
talk to people, you look at statistical data. How did it sell last time? How did the Army Corps sell the last time we did it? How did the Christmas show sell the last time we did it? What was the response? How many people left it in remission? How are pre-ticket sales? As a choral organization, which you can probably relate to, we have another layer of engagement because our singers are all volunteers. Mm-hmm. So we have 200 volunteers that we need to make sure are on board and engaged and enthused about the music, because they are by far our best marketers, our best ticket sellers, and our best advocates. I've realized is actually one of the sort of secret weapons of the Turtle Creek Chorale, and I'm sure it is for other choral organizations, is that when the singers are engaged, when they really love what they're doing, much like it would be when in a theater production, where the cast really loves what they're doing, there's this connection, this heart connection between the audience and the performer that's completely unspoken, but it's an engagement that is palpable, and it enriches the experience. And I don't know that, maybe I'm speaking blasphemy, I don't know that some of the big organizations have that. I think when you have a stage full of professional musicians that are being paid to do their job, it's a different paradigm to the audience than it is when you have 200 volunteers up there who are there for a very different reason. I think the connection with the audience is very different.
When you're talking about that, we have experienced that too, where you're like, it's like,
right,
you
right,
can
right.
feel it.
It's why community theater is so magic. And it's, it's why, you could probably see a better show at the Dallas Theater Center, but, the heart that comes into a community organization is so important, and I think that's it's also the struggle that we have as the Turtle Creek Chorale, in that we're a 32-year-old, nearly million-dollar budget arts organization. I mean, we're playing with the big dogs, and so. managing an all volunteer roster of musicians is a bit like herding cats.
Well, speaking of herding cats, what do you like to do in your free time, which it sounds like you don't really have a lot of time, beyond making soap?
I go to arts events. I love, you know, adventurous dining. I have a 7-year-old, so he takes care. He takes care of most of that free time. Just enjoy going to art events, just throwing a ball out in the backyard, renovating a house.
Well, I have one other question real quickly. Since you made the comment about starting in band in the third grade, as I did as well, what was there a pivotal moment in your childhood where really something artistic just struck you so strongly that you knew that it was something you would never let go of?
I can't really think of a pivotal moment, but it really is something that has always been there. I was so blessed to be a part of the public education system in Northern California before 1976, which is when Proposition 13 came on and was the sort of first big change in the nation's funding of public school. So, I had an amazingly good public education where I could choose between band and drama and art, and it was unthinkable that you wouldn't have all three of those in your curriculum. So then coming full circle, 25 years later, when I'm suddenly a parent and I'm looking at how to educate my child, I was like, wow, things really have changed since I was a kid.
Well, great. Well, we are on to our last segment, and it's our 1-minute quick answer game called the Top 10 Shorties. Do we have our timer all set for 1 minute?
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Ready, set, and
blue.
Go. Ah. You're in a meeting and taking notes. Do you use a pen or a pencil?
Pen.
If you were to go back to theater, what would be the first play you would produce?
Away.
Away. Okay. Now, away from the Turtle Creek Corral, what do you find yourself doing most for fun?
Sleeping.
Sleeping. Okay. Elvis or the Beatles?
Ooh, Beatles.
If you had $1 million, what would be the first item you would buy?
The contractor services.
Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Your favorite fast food?
Wendy's fries.
Okay. Are you a cat or dog person?
Cat.
And the last question, what's your favorite fragrance of soap to make, and could I get some of that?
It's a blend that when I was selling soap, it was called Lavender Dream. It's about 50% lavender, about 25% orange, and about 25% patchouli. I'll make you a bunch.
Great. And that's our top 10 shorties. Well, this is Airtime, and I'm your moderator, Chris Tucker. Arts Incubator of Richardson would like to give special thanks to Deborah Carter and Repertory Company Theater for hosting this event. We invite you to check out artsincubatorrichardson.org for future events and news.
Thank you for listening to Airtime with Chris Tucker. To learn more about AIR, please visit our website at artsincubatorrichardson.com.